Session of 1268, Reel 1.
Mr. Beverton, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born locally in Ilford and was brought up for the first few years of my life until the war broke out in near Gents Hill.
What did your father do for a living?
My father worked in the London Post Office as a supervisor in the sorting department and retired about 40 years ago.
Were you educated in the Ilford area?
Yes, my school was Wanstead County High School, which I got out of my scholarship. And I used to walk to and from the school until my mother and father split up. And then I used to go and have a cycle to school.
What age were you when you left school?
The war broke out when I was 15 to 16. And I went into evacuation late because I didn't want to go and leave home, first of all. Went into evacuation, and I eventually left school in 1942 in the summer, having done about 3 years in a sixth form.
Where were you evacuated to?
Well, the first place we went to was up on the east coast, Maldon, and when the Germans broke through in 1940, about May, June, we were evacuated further west by a long train journey which took us across southern England to Gloucestershire. We ended up in Newent, a little village near the Forest of Dean. And being a boy of 15, 16, we were sort of regarded as not fit for any of the local villagers to be put up by them. And we were sent to a tramps home at Pontley Court, which was rather sort of a mayhem area to be living in. And eventually, after about 3 or 4 weeks, we were transferred to a billet in a small town and eventually ended up in Chippenham in Wiltshire, where I stayed until I took my final higher schools examination in 1942.
What did you think to the conditions you had as an evacuee?
Well, at the time, being a teenager, I felt rather selfish, but I wasn't aware of my own selfishness and I thought I was shabbily treated. I was a bit of a loner in some respects, so therefore I found that I missed home a lot and all the comforts of home, particularly when I went to Maldon. I had to go and sleep three in a bed with two other boys when I'd been used to sleeping one in a bed. But when I realised that the billet hostesses didn't get much more than about a few shillings a week to go and feed us as teenagers, obviously I realised that they were doing a difficult job under difficult circumstances. And the longer I stayed in my billet in Chippenham, which was about 18 months the time I'd left, well, I was on very good terms with the my landlady. But, of course, as she came from a working-class family, she thought, boy of 17, rising 18, when I was about leaving, I should have been out at work since I was about 14, not being a sort of a charge on the state or a charge on her own bill of fare.
Did she make that plain to you?
Oh, she did, yes. She said that keeping you was like keeping a herd of elephants. And she also said that I couldn't expect to have the life I was used to at home unless I paid more money. So my father gave an extra 5 shillings a week to help out with the burden of keeping me. And I looked after my own rations to prove that I could live on my rations without having to go and bother her for other food.
So she was a plain-speaking woman?
She was a plain-speaking woman, you're quite right about that. But she was a difficult person to get on with because I had a small room on the top floor of the cottage where we were staying, and I went to bed with a candle, which she insisted that I turned out or blew out every night after I'd got undressed. She took all the chairs out of the room, so I had nowhere to put my clothes when I went to bed at night. And eventually, because I left splash marks on the washstand, could be washed with a jug and basin of water, she said I had to go into the wash house in the garden to wash out in the morning. So having got used to these Spartan activities, I sort of knuckled down and got on with it. And eventually I managed to stay the course until the summer of 1942.
This was at Chippenham?
Chippenham in Wiltshire, yes.
Was there much difference between boys like yourself from London and those that you met out in places like Chippenham and Newent and Maldon?
There was not much to choose from, but I think the local people found that having London boys, particularly boys, because they tend to be a bit noisy and boisterous, were sort of a drain on their resources, and they weren't prettily dressed like the girls, so therefore they tended to be a little bit offhand with us. But they felt they were doing a job for the country, I suppose, so they probably felt that they were doing the right thing in taking us in. But the local people in the local school, the local children, that is, treated us as equals. I mean, apart from some rivalry on the football pitch or rugby pitch or cricket matches and so forth when we played against them, which we didn't always win, and made us feel that we were on equal terms with their boys or their children.
In what way were the adults offhand with you?
Well, I was in three billets in Chippenham. The first billet I was thrown out because I played cards on Sunday with my other roommate. And I also kept a diary in those days, which I'd been keeping since 1939. And I used to write my diary up each day or each week. And I left it in my dressing table drawer. And the landlady eventually discovered this diary and read it, found that I'd written about herself, and got heated very hot under the collar as a result. Took it out to the school, tore out the pages that were offending her, and immediately I was due for the chop. I took great exception to it from my point of view, because I thought she had no right to go and read private property which was stashed away amongst my shirts in my drawer. But she said it just fell out the drawer when she was putting my clothes away, which I found hard to believe. But anyway, I had to go. So I went into another billet in Marshfield Road, which was a much more prosperous person's house. And I was warned about this by the next-door neighbour, friend, who I used to go to school with, saying that they're mad in that house. Well, I didn't realise what he meant until I arrived at the place, and there was a perpetual feud going on between husband and wife, which went on all hours of the day and night. He was accused of bringing women into the house and so forth. And she had a great feeling of self-preservation. And as a result of the arguments with him, she sort of locked the door at certain times of the day. And both her sons, two sons she had, and myself were forced to go and walk the streets or fill in the time until she was prepared to let us in at 5 o'clock in the evening, or 6 o'clock in the evening, as the case may be. I didn't have a key to the place. I had to wait until the door was opened. And then the third place, because I asked to leave that one because I found I couldn't get the work done. Homework was difficult to get done. And eventually I went to the third place, which was the other end of town, where I think they were more working class in their outlook. And there I was accused of taking up a lot of time, being at home, reading lots of books, which I had to, of course, for my advanced level sixth form work. I had deadlines to meet and so forth, with essay writing and so on. And I was criticised for spending so much time in the house. So as a result of that, I was pleased to get on my bike and go outside into the country, find a little quiet field or in the wood at Harden Huish, the other side of town, or sitting in a churchyard as I did at Harnish Church, and doing my sixth form work there. And eventually I found the Methodist Sunday school rooms in the town, which were open in the evening and open at weekends, and I used to go and do my work in there and return after a suitable number of hours had elapsed. But I was criticised quite a lot for being indoors. And the only pleasing smiles I got from my landlady, first of all, was when I sort of went out on my bike, disappeared for a whole evening, after having sat on the station in the waiting room trying to read my books there, or going out to the local cinema more often than I probably should have done. But that was the offhand attitude. I mean, they had no children, so I suppose they looked upon me as a difficult person to get on with. And in fairness to them, I suppose I was difficult, inasmuch as I was an only child, and as a result of being left to my own devices, I felt rather, I won't say superior, but I felt that I had rights which other people should recognise. although I didn't put it into those words as I have done now today.
Were you unhappy in this evacuation?
I was unhappy a lot of the time because I couldn't get on with my British hostess in the last one, but I determined not to go and leave the place and to stick it out. And eventually, the lady in question and myself got along very well indeed. But as I say, it's only because I used to go out of an evening. I was never there in an evening after meal times. And eventually, in the last year, a group of us in the sixth form joined a club above the library in the town square, where we all thought we'd get together over our homework, do our work in this club. And we also found it was a very suitable place to learn to play poker, where we were taught, and also to play pool, billiards and snooker. And so I started my downward decline, but on the other hand, I felt much happier as soon as we became members of this Chippenham Social Club. We were the right age, we were over 16, so we could join. And I think about six of us joined eventually. And we met some of the local men in the town who were only too willing to go and take us on as war recruits at the billiard table. But I'm very pleased about it because in the army there were billiard tables to be played on, and it's nice to be accepted as a billiard or snooker player. And in later life, in the staff room at schools where I taught, it was a social asset to be able to play a game like billiards or snooker before it achieved its popularity of today.
Did you join the Home Guard?
No.
Did you know of its existence in your area?
Yes. That I had no desire to go and join the services before my call-up time came, unlike my friends who volunteered for Navy or Air Force, because I wanted to get into university. I'd planned right from the beginning to become a teacher, because my grandmother was a teacher in Dockland, and when she was alive, I think she must have influenced me in my chosen career. And so I'd already made overtures to King's College London and to Bristol University. King's College London said that when I was still at school that I should wait until I'd come out of the services, but Bristol University offered me a place in October 1942. So consequently, I accepted it.
What was it that you wanted to study at the university?
Languages. German was my main subject, and I did English as a subsidiary. Did an honours degree in German.
So this brings us on to your career in the war in Japanese. Can you tell me how you came to be connected with that, please?
Well, yes. As I indicated, I wanted to get to university. So having got my feet under the table, as it were, in the autumn of 1942, I thought of means of keeping out of the services as long as possible. But I knew my days would be numbered, because when my 18th birthday would be due at the end of December 1942, I knew my call-up papers would be on the table. So I also had German friends. I didn't say this earlier, but in the years before the war, I went on several exchanges to Germany, and I got to know a fair number of people in Germany, teenage boys, in Leverkusen, outside Cologne, one of whose parents worked for the IG Farben, the chemical industry in Germany. And I got on very well with him. We were very close friends. And I didn't want to fight against the Germans, because I thought I might be shooting at my friend and other friends I had over there. I suppose I was also influenced by, although I hate to say this, by the fact that I wore a sort of Hitler Youth uniform, mainly for the fun of it, and I thought the glamour of wearing a uniform like that with a little dagger at my side was very exciting. And I didn't want to go and sort of shoot anybody who was on the other side wearing these uniforms. Of course, as a teenager, I didn't realise what was going on in Germany. We didn't hear very much about it in the press. It wasn't until the war started, but I still had this feeling I wanted to go and be friendly with my German colleagues. And so it wasn't until the Japanese came in the war that, or there was moves towards the Japanese coming in. I didn't really mind the possibility of fighting the Japanese, because the propaganda in our own country always depicted the Japanese as subhuman, ape-like individuals. And so I suppose I had no feelings about that. And so when my call-up papers came in December 42, the dean of the Faculty of Arts in Bristol University, through Dr. Kloss, my German professor, had recommended me for, or suggested I apply for the inter-service course on Japanese, which was in operation at the time. I think it started in the summer of 42. And so I applied, and the day before I went into the services, at the end of the month, I was called for an interview with the joint staff represented, Army, Navy and Air Force. All the top brass, it seemed to me, but lots of gold braid all over the place. And they interviewed me. They asked me questions in German and French. And then I was told I would have to wait, but I was accepted. So when I went into primary training at Norwich Barracks, Mousehold Heath, I think it was called, I felt rather smug in that I knew I was going to eventually learn Japanese and go out to the Far East. So that was my initiation into Japanese. Also, of course, I like languages, and Japanese was a different sort of language from the Indo-European languages. So I thought, well, this would be a great, exciting scheme of things to try.
And what was the next step?
Well, I went into the services at Norwich. The first day I was in there, I'm afraid I complained about my feet. Although I was A1, they sent me to what they called a PDC, a physical development centre, which meant that I had to go to Kingston on Thames, the barracks over there, after I'd done only a fortnight in Norwich, for a 2-month course in Kirokure, as far as I can see. It was run by tough cookies in the P department of the army. And although you got up later in the morning, it meant that, and you had nice milky breakfasts, and you had cocoa in mid-morning. It consisted mainly of unarmed combat, boxing, assault courses, a lot of bayonet stuff, and 10-mile route marches, which had to be done with all your kit within 2 hours. And if you didn't do it within 2 hours, you jolly well had to go and do it again and again and again until you'd done it. But at the same time, because, as I said, I had this foot trouble, which was as a result of high arches, Pez Carvers, I think they call it, I had Faradism. electrical treatment and so forth for my feet during the afternoon. And as a result of the course, I decided to really push it hard to get my tear my root mite out of the way. So I did it the first time through Kingston Park, Roehampton area. And after that, I had a cushy time. And at the end of the course, when they started rechecking our fitness for the front, I suppose, I found myself downgraded from A1 to A2, in spite of the fact that I did the marching, but purely because of the foot trouble I legitimately had. So I was sent back to Norwich after my 2 months' training, met the sergeant again, who'd seen me before, and I had a soft number there, because instead of doing them the counter-marching up and down the barrack square, I was allowed to sit on the parapet to rest my feet. And the only thing I could think of any usefulness of this marching was the fact that in later years and months, when I had to collect my pay, you had to go up to the table and you march up there, salute, up 1-2, down 1-2, take your money, about turn 1-2, back to your place in the queue. And I could see no other reason for it apart from route marching. But anyway, as a result of that, I finished my primary training, and then, of course, as all the other recruits over there, look at the postings, and I found that my posting was for the Duke of York's headquarters in Chelsea in London. And eventually I took the train to the Duke of York's headquarters. They accepted my arrival, wanted to know where I lived. When I told them I lived in Ilford, Redbridge, they said, well, it'd be cheaper to keep you at home, Beverton. So I was given a pass, a monthly pass, and straight away got on a train with all my kit, gas mask, tin hat, the lot, and arrived home, much to my mother's consternation, who didn't know where, thought I was in Norwich. So I arrived at home and I stayed there for the next 18 months, virtually, going to and from the School of Oriental and African Studies to learn my Japanese translation stuff.
How did you cope with the language?
I found it fascinating. It was so different from the European languages. And although we did, first of all, mainly oral work from an oral book, the emphasis became more on the written side of it as time went by, because we were going to be translators, and I joined the class called Translators 5, which we amongst ourselves called ourselves Traducers Quint, which meant, all it meant that was that we were the fifth class since the inception of the course to learn Japanese or to study Japanese. And we had quite a large number of people, very well qualified staff, to take us through the language, who not only did it from a linguistic point of view, but also from the cultural, historical, social point of view as well, right from the beginning. And we had, I think it was Mrs. Edwards, who was or Professor Edwards, I think perhaps she was called, who was in charge of the running of all the courses. But one of our regular lecturers was Major General Pickett, who was, I think, the military attaché in Tokyo until war broke out. We had Mr. Shokiko, who was from Formosa, Taiwanese, who was a member of the church, and he gave us linguistic help. We had a Lieutenant McGee, who was a naval man, very tall, impeccably dressed, unlike ourselves. We had a Mr. Matsukawa, who was a Japanese newspaper reporter, who we found difficult to understand because most of the time he seemed to hiss through his teeth, which meant that we had Japanese with a lisp, or so it seemed. I think they were the main people who taught us. And we had various tests to do, of course, on a regular basis to make sure we were keeping abreast of the time. We had lessons in Japanese morality, or social morality, I should say. We picked up a wide range of vocabulary from hiko bakudan, meaning high explosive bomb, to ona, woman, shito, man, simple stuff like that. So we had a whole range of things, and we had to learn Japanese etiquette and Japanese customs as well. We had a book on those. But being university students, or not long having been university students, I'm afraid we treated life at the school, first of all, with a certain amount of irreverence, because, dare I say this? Because when top brass arrived at given times, we used to pelt them with chalk from one of the upstairs windows. We used to collect Belisha beacons, as students tend to do so. We used to go down to the Salvation Army Canadian Canteen in Russell Square. And as a result of all this, our work didn't suffer, I thought, but our attitude did. And we were regarded as a bit beyond the pale and needed taking in hand. And so we were given a sorbet sky, which for the uninitiated means a farewell party, which was normally given to all the classes which achieved their goal, passed their examination tests, and reached the end of their course before they went out to serve. And ours came about halfway through our course. We were given the sorbet sky, and as a result, we amended our ways and became model students, as you can imagine.
You were given this as a kind of warning signal, were you?
It was a warning, yes. I mean, when we actually had the proper sorbet sky in that first one, the mock sorbet sky, I should call it, took place in the autumn, I think it was, of 1943. But when we had our final one, the proper one, Major General Piggott, who made a farewell speech, says that he no doubt knew that we had left our mark in the school, and I think we were taking it very literally because of all the tables we'd knocked down and the anxious moments that Otome Daniels, who was instantly another